Good afternoon, everybody. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Hey, the Oscar nominations are out. The nomination of note is probably Black Panther for Best Picture. According to the New York Times, it's the first superhero film to get the nod. Here at All of It, the team and I are really excited for all our recent guests who are honored. Get this. Willem Dafoe has been nominated for Best Actor at Eternity's Gate. Yorgos Lanthimos nominated for Best Director for The Favourite. Pavel Pavlovsky nominated for Best Director for Cold War. If Beale Street Could Talk was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. And of course, we talked to Barry Jenkins. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. Tim Blake Nelson was here. Mary Queen of Scots was nominated for Makeup and for Costume Design. And we talked to Saoirse Ronan about what it was like to dress up and all that. And we had three guests from three of the films nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, including Nadine Labaki. Congratulations to all the nominees who've come through this studio in our first season of All of It. Tomorrow on the show, we'll have a full dive into the nominations, the favorites, the snubs, all of it. But up first on this freezing Tuesday, we're going to start with Grudges. Grudges are good. A grudge is right. A grudge works. Okay, that's really from the Gordon Gekko speech in Wall Street about greed, but it does seem to apply to grudges too, at least according to the best-selling crime novelist turned grudge expert Sophie Hannah. Tired of seeing grudges getting a bad rap, Sophie decided to investigate how our lingering resentments can actually be good for us, as long as we process them in the right way. She writes, quote, "Grudges, when held correctly, are an essential part of a healthy psychological diet." Her book, How to Hold a Grudge, From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life, is chock full of helpful tips from why creating a grudge cabinet is necessary, we'll get her to explain, to a how-to guide for ranking the seriousness of your grudges on a scale of 1 to 10. The whole thing might make you feel a little bit better about that one thing you just can't seem to let go. How to Hold a Grudge is out now, and the grudge guru herself, Sophie Hannah, joins us. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Your expertise in grudges was pointed out by your sister, who said this about you, quote, "Sophie, you devote more care and attention to the collection, analysis, and maintenance of a grudge than anyone I know."
That's true. And then we started to have a conversation about why it might be that some people held lots of grudges and other people didn't. And I thought I will go away and do a search for books about grudges to try and see if anyone's analyzed this. You know, what are the personality traits that make you more or less likely to hold grudges? And when I did my search, I found that not one single book on the specific subject of grudges existed. And I couldn't believe that because grudges are so common. They're everywhere. You know, they form the plots of plays, movies, the songs. So many songs on my playlist are about grudges. And most of us at some point in our lives have either held a grudge or tried not to hold a grudge. And I just couldn't believe that such a common and widespread psychological phenomenon had not one single book written about it.
I love the sound of it. It's like it's onomatopoeia. At the height, grudge, like you hold a grudge.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing I noticed when I started talking about it with my sister was that I had always enjoyed my grudges. I'd never felt that they made me feel angry or bitter or hostile. I had always liked having grudges because they actually made me feel empowered and protected and as though I had a realistic assessment of what was likely to happen to me if I continued to have relationships with particular people. And so I'd read lots and lots of self-help books. I'm a bit of a self-help addict. And I'd read loads of books which always stressed the power of positive thinking. And, you know, if you want to have inner peace, then you've got to let go of all grudges and all resentment. And I started to think, well, hold on a minute. Grudges and resentment are not the same thing. Obviously, if you're full of resentment, that's going to make you miserable, and it might make you lash out at people and generally create grumpiness in the world. But my grudges were not doing that. My grudges were entertaining me, they were protecting me, they were inspiring me, they were helping me to understand what my highest values and priorities were. There was nothing negative about them. So then I started to do this research thinking somebody needs to write a book about grudges and that person might as well be me because I'm interested in the subject. And I thought I'm going to write a self-help book explaining why I believe that actually holding grudges is really, really good for us. And so the first step, really, of my research was to look at the dictionary definitions of the word grudge. And all of them, without exception, said a grudge is a feeling of resentment, bitterness, anger. And I realized that my grudges were not feelings. My grudges were stories that I chose to remember because they were useful to me. So that was the first step. And when I looked at it like that, I thought, no wonder most self-help advice is don't hold grudges, because if all the dictionaries say a grudge is a resentful feeling, well, nobody's going to think that's good for us. But I knew from years of personal experience that my grudges were not feelings. They were useful stories from which I could glean loads of really beneficial life lessons.
You say in your book that we shouldn't ever hold a grudge against someone, only about them. So what's the difference?
It's the language. So if you hold a grudge, if you talk about holding grudges against people, then that suggests that the grudge is almost a weapon. You've got this thing and you're going to use it against someone. I'm arguing in my book that grudges are not negative things at all. In fact, one of my rules for safe and beneficial grudge holding is that your grudge must never do any harm either to you or to the person you hold it about. And so if you say, I have a grudge about Mary, then it's a story about Mary that I'm choosing to remember because I feel it still has a live charge of relevance in my life. But it's not a grudge against Mary because it's in no way is it aimed at attacking or making her life worse. So, I mean, it's a little linguistic point, but I do think, you know, I'm trying to rehabilitate the word and recommend to people that we should all hold grudges in a wholesome and beneficial way. And so cleaning up the language around grudges is really essential to that. If we say a grudge against, that sounds aggressive, it sounds combative. If you say a grudge about, that sounds much more benign. It's just a story about somebody you know.
Would you share one of your stories, which is a grudge you have about someone as opposed to against?
Yes. Okay. So one that's in the book. In fact, it's a very important grudge in the book because, as I explain in the introduction, it's the first grudge that I was aware of creating in real time. So until this grudge came along, what used to happen would be someone would do something, I'd be annoyed in the moment, and then sometime later I'd realize that I still remembered that thing. It didn't feel as though it no longer mattered. It still felt as though it mattered. And I'd think, oh, okay, I seem to have a grudge about that. But with this particular story, immediately during the incident while it was occurring, I was thinking, I can feel a grudge being created. I'm going to remember every detail of this story. I'm going to consolidate and analyze this story, and it's going to be a great grudge story. And the story was this. My friend Michael, with whom I used to sometimes stay the night. If I was in the part of the country where he lived, then I would stay with him and his wife, Linda. And one night, I was fast asleep in the guest room with the light off and the door closed, and I suddenly jolted awake and realized that the door was open, the light was on, and Michael was standing in the doorway, bent double, looking under the bed that I was sleeping in. So I was really alarmed. I was like, why has he come into my room? Why has he turned on the light? I was really freaked out. And he said, I'm just looking for the dog. Is he in here? And I said, I've no idea. I was asleep. And then at that moment, Linda, Michael's wife, called out from the next room, oh, it's okay, Michael, he's in here. Now, in that next room, nobody was sleeping. So I realized that, you know, Michael wanted to find his dog. I was asleep in this room. What he should have done was check the rest of the house before barging into the room where I was sleeping and waking me up. I mean, obviously, it's not a war crime. You know, I'm not saying this is the most serious offense that's ever been committed. But he hadn't even checked the rest of the house before he decided he was willing to walk into my room, turn the light on at 3 a.m. and wake me up. Now, when I realized that this was a grudge forming in real time, I connected that story to other Michael stories from past experiences of staying in his house, and I realized that almost every time I stayed with him and his wife, he found a way to ruin my night's sleep. So quite often it would be he would play very loud music very early in the morning before I'd woken up. And when I'd spoken to him about this and said, oh, I woke up at 7 because you were playing really loud rock music, he would sort of say, oh, well, it's my house and I like listening to music when I get dressed in the morning.
Oh, Michael sounds like a pain. So
he's a pain.
He sounds like a huge pain.
Weirdly, you know, he has lots of other really good qualities. He really does. So I didn't want to stop being friends with him. I didn't want to, you know, shout at him or have a row or do anything hostile, but I did want to remember that he behaves inconsiderately around whether his house guests get any sleep or not. I think he just is someone who needs to be able to do exactly what he wants in his own house whenever he wants, and so he's just not well suited to having house guests. So I don't think it's okay to wake your guests up when they're asleep, unless you absolutely have to. So I have that grudge about Michael. It doesn't mean I don't like him and that I don't want to see him and be friends with him, but it does mean that I'm not going to be spending any more nights in his house, and if I go and see him, I'll stay in a hotel instead.
My guest is Sophie Hannah. She's written a book called How to Hold a Grudge. So some of your advice about processing and letting go of grudges, or at least holding on to them in a way that is beneficial to you, is you talk about a grudge it. Having a grudge it.
Yes.
What is that?
The grudge it, one of the things I recommend is that as well as your grudge stories, which are basically, I think of them as symbolic justice objects. So human beings are justice-seeking creatures. If somebody treats us appallingly, we say, this is unfair. We object to the unfairness. And often, if there's no legal, you know, avenue of getting any kind of satisfaction once you've been treated badly, often we feel as though the person who's wronged us has just got away with it. They did a terrible thing. Nothing has happened to them. It's almost as though it didn't matter at all. By giving ourselves permission to consciously and constructively create our grudge story and analyze it and distill it for life lessons, by doing that, we create a symbolic justice object, and that tells us that the person hasn't totally got away with it, and it's not as though it never happened because we have our grudge. So the person hasn't totally got away with it scot-free. So it's important to remember those things, but it's equally important to hold what I call gratitude grudges. So if there's an incident in your life where somebody does something really kind or someone goes out of their way to help you or to make your day as happy as it can be, any sort of good deed that sort of makes an impression on you, I advocate creating a gratitude grudge. So that these stories that we remember because they are sort of significant emotional landmarks or things that feel as though they still have relevance when we remember them, it's equally important to have stories about great things that happened as stories about bad things that were done to us. So that's part of keeping a good solid grudge it. And grudge it is just an abbreviation of grudge budget, in case anyone wondered. The other thing I recommend is not to keep any grudges in your grudge cabinet that you no longer need. So, for example, if Michael were to suddenly ring me up tonight and say, oh, wow, I've just realized that I've been so selfish whenever you've stayed the night at my house. I've just been incredibly selfish and I've interrupted your sleep and I can't believe I thought that was okay. I'm so sorry. I will never do that again. That would tell me that Michael had really realized what he'd done wrong in those situations, and I would have no further need of that grudge because, well, unless I went and stayed with him and he did it again, then I'd have to reintroduce a grudge. But basically, if somebody knows that they've messed up and they properly apologize and you know that they get it and you trust them not to do it again, then there's no need for a grudge. So it's kind of unnecessary and petty to remember a grudge or to keep holding a grudge when the person won't do that behavior again.
You have a great quiz that you can take, or a questionnaire that you can take to find out if your grudge is on a scale of 1 to 10. And it's interesting, I took one with somebody who I thought was like an 11 grudge for me personally. But after going and taking the quiz, I only came in at about a 4. And it was really interesting to me that something that was so big in my mind, maybe it wasn't that big. Maybe, you know, it's 25 years ago. Let it go, girl.
The grading process, so the questions you have to answer in order to grade a grudge, it's a very comprehensive list of questions, and it evaluates all kinds of different things from, did the person intend to harm you, or did they accidentally harm you while trying to do something nice? I mean, that's one question. Another is, how close is this person to you? Is it your nearest and dearest family member, or is it a stranger that you walked past on the street? Because depending on your relationship to the person, you might decide they had more of a responsibility to think of your best interests, or not so much of a responsibility. And then other questions are things like, how badly did the grudge-worthy incident affect you? Did it affect you terribly badly, or were you basically fine but just mildly annoyed? So there's all these questions, and the aim is to come up with a fairly authoritative ranking. So, for example, in the book, I've got an example of each of my grades of grudge. So I start with a 1-carat grudge, and I lead up to a 10-carat grudge. And I answered all the questions for each one. And when I looked at the order of significance and power of the grudge that I ended up ranking those grudges in, it felt very accurate. So I tested the system until it worked. So I tested it until I ended up with the order that they came out in corresponding with my knowledge of how much I cared about each one and how sort of powerful each one felt to me.
My guest is Sophie Hannah. The name of her book is How to Hold a Grudge from Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. I'm curious why people have trouble letting go of grudges, why they hold on to them. Is there something evolutionary where we think by holding this grudge, I'm protecting myself from something bad happening?
I don't know whether it's evolutionary. I think it's, we interact with people all the time, and it's useful information for us to have whether those people treat us well or not. And sometimes when they don't treat us well, or, you know, maybe inadvertently, they not deliberately, but they do something that really hurts us, that makes an impression on us. We go through life and people either make us feel better or worse, and we remember that. It's very hard to forget. It's very hard, if not impossible, to say to yourself, whatever that person did, I'm just going to feel and think about them exactly the same as I feel and think about this other person who's only ever been lovely to me and never hurt me at all. And I don't think we should think the same way about people who've never hurt us as we do about people who've regularly hurt us. To go back to Michael again, you know, he's never done anything terrible to me by any means, but of all the people who've been in my life for a long time, he is one of the ones who most regularly has caused me, I wouldn't say harm, but annoyance, frustration. You know, he's most regularly sort of inconvenienced me or been selfish towards me or ruined my afternoon. So he is someone I want to have grudges about because they inform the way I go forward in my relationship with him. Now, that doesn't mean I don't forgive him. And here's another big, big angle of my grudge-holding theory. I believe that if you hold grudges in the right way, you actually are able to forgive people emotionally much more readily. And the reason for that is that what you do is you separate out your intellectual judgment and conclusions and the decisions you make about whether this thing that they did was okay or not and what you're going to do about it, like how you're going to think differently to protect yourself in future. So you do all that intellectually. You create your symbolic commemorative justice object in the form of your grudge. And then your emotions don't feel, any negative emotions you've got, they don't feel they have to cling on and be unforgiving because they don't feel that that person has just got away with it. So they think, okay, the grudge is now sorted. Now I can move on emotionally. So for me, holding a grudge in the way I advocate actually makes it much easier to forgive people.
The name of the book is How to Hold a Grudge from Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. Everyone go out there, transform your grudges. Sophie Hannah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Coming up, we continue to turn self-help on its head with a tiny book about the joy of others' misfortunes. There's more of all of it after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC for the next installment of Feeling All the Feelings, an hour with attitude. Let's take a look at the phenomenon of getting pleasure from other people's misfortune, also known as Schadenfreude. Not sure what that means? We'll let the cast of Avenue Q explain.
How about straight-A students getting B's?
X's getting STDs.
Waking doormen from their naps.
Watching tourists reading maps.
Football players getting tackled.
CEOs getting shackled.
Watching actors never reach the ending of their Oscar speech.
Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude.
Yep, the Cheeky Musical devoted a whole song to it. While you may feel a wee bit guilty about indulging in this emotion, our next guest says don't. Tiffany Watts Smith, a historian of emotion, is the author of the book Schadenfreude, The Joy of Others' Misfortunes. And in it, she writes, quote, "This book explores many interconnection species of Schadenfreude, each with its illicit pleasure to be savored." Tiffany, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
That made you laugh yourself, hearing it.
The slight, because Schadenfreude is such an interesting emotion, but it always carries that tang of slight shame and guilt that you'd even confess to have felt it at all. So, yes, it is funny to hear myself confessing to it on there.
So it's a German word, but you note in the book, by looking at the words in other languages and the set of feelings in other languages, can you share some?
Other words for Schadenfreude in other languages?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, There are other languages that have this word for this sort of malicious delight. There's one that I thought was quite interesting was from a remote atoll. It's in the Pacific Ocean. It's called Banbanum, which is sort of scoffing and smirking at your rival's great mishap or embarrassment. But certainly, yeah, there are words in Danish, in Yiddish, in France, in Japan, they have a saying: the misfortunes of others taste like honey, which I thought was rather marvelous.
You quote a wide range of sources, from philosophers to great novelists of Western culture. How did you go about researching Schadenfreude?
Well, I'm a historian of emotion, so that's what I do for my living. And you can find about the history of emotion in all kinds of different sources. I mean, as you say, philosophers have been interested in emotions, and they've definitely been very interested in this particular emotion for a very long time. So you hear about it in Aristotle. You hear about it in the Roman philosopher and poet Lucretius. He's kind of one of the earliest people who thinks about this emotion and why we might have it and what does it tell us about ourselves. So when we look at when we look at the history of emotions, we can definitely look at philosophy. We can definitely look at the history of medicine and the history of psychology and psychiatry. So when we look at the history of psychology, we can see that Schadenfreude slightly gets a new interpretation at the end of the 19th century from something which is kind of quite fun and playful into people starting to think about sadism and much more sinister forms of malicious delight we might have in other people. So how does the history of psychiatry then change this particular word? And we can definitely look at paintings, we can look at pop songs, we can look at novels, and we'd look at all of these sources to try and piece together this kind of strange and sometimes fragmentary history of an emotion.
Well, what does Schadenfreude reveal about us humans?
Well, this is the thing that really hooked me into this emotion, because on the one hand, it seems like something faintly embarrassing, maybe something we prefer not to admit to in ourselves, maybe something a little spiteful or malicious. On the other hand, you know, it's an amazing window into all kinds of things that we really value as in our human societies. For example, we tend to feel a lot of schadenfreude when someone who's done something wrong or been hypocritical or been showing off gets some kind of comeuppance. So, for example, I mean, it's ridiculous, but on the way here today, someone shoved past me on the escalator as I was trying to get out of the tube station, and then they got stuck in the ticket barriers, and I felt this sort of terrible little moment of, you know, karma. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous, but yet, you know, it just shows how deep down we sort of what sort of pleasure we feel when we see someone who's tried to break the rules, who's someone who's tried to get sort of one up on us, then get punished, you know, even if it's only by a minor sort of infraction. So I think schadenfreude reveals our commitment to justice. It reveals our commitment to fairness. But it also reveals how important how much importance we give to comparing ourselves to one another, and that sort of terrible, irresistible urge to measure yourself against your neighbour and see how well or not well you might be doing. And in those moments of competition, when we might not be doing, we might feel ourselves to not be doing as well as our neighbour or colleague or friend or whatever. Then when they experience some minor setback, you know, we do feel it as a little burst of a tiny sort of unearned triumph or as a little moment to make yourself feel a bit better about your own inadequacies. You know, it's not you that fails. You know, everyone does. And, you know, of course, we're all told that we shouldn't compare ourselves to one another. But, you know, as humans, this is part of our nature. And I think I think trying to sort of stare schadenfreude in the face and understand, you know, what happens when we feel it, I think it's important to just to help us recognize that this is just an ordinary part of being human.
My guest is Tiffany Watt-Smith. She's written the book Schadenfreude, The Joy of Another's Misfortune. You write there are five themes to how schadenfreude is used in English. What are they?
There are different ways in which we define the word schadenfreude, I think, was the idea here. So one important thing is that schadenfreude is something that we tend not to confess to. So it's something usually illicit and rather hidden. I mean, if you do tell other people about your schadenfreude, sometimes that's because other people agree with you. So if you're in a group or a tribe, sometimes that's just evidence that you are quite malicious and terrible. So you tend to get, you know, your Hollywood villain would be overtly expressing schadenfreude. So that's one thing. Another thing is that we tend to feel it in response to fairly minor mishaps. So we tend not to gloat when someone dies, or we don't tend to do that outwardly. But of course, there are sometimes exceptions. But it tends to be in response to fairly minor mishaps. The third thing is that it tends to be a spectator sport, if you like. It's an emotion that we enjoy when we ourselves have not caused the misfortune of the other person, but in fact just they happen to experience something bad happens to happen to them, either by accident or because someone else's intervention, and we, standing on the sidelines, get to kind of enjoy the spectacle of their decline. A fourth thing is that we feel it much more powerfully and strongly when we form ourselves into groups. So schadenfreude, many studies have shown again and again that schadenfreude is really strong, really pronounced when we are in rival tribes. This is partly because we use schadenfreude to sort of as a way of denigrating our enemies and therefore sort of entrenching those rivalries and oppositions even further. But also, schadenfreude is an important way in which we bond. So we share a sort of malicious giggle around the water cooler or whatever it is. It's part of kind of showing our allegiances. And that's why it's very strong in groups. And the fifth one, obviously, is that schadenfreude really is pronounced when it comes to rivalries, when we're trying to get one up on someone or at least make ourselves feel slightly less inadequate when they have done particularly well.
You did some of your research involved dissecting fail videos on YouTube when people try something and they fail spectacularly. And there's a bit of science about laughing and pain and laughing at someone else's pain. Could you share that with us?
Yes, this was a study done in Oxford University by Robin Dunbar, who's an evolutionary psychologist. And he was looking at, him and his team were looking at different kinds of laughter, and they were looking at the relationship between laughing and sensitivity to pain. And one of the things they found was that people only tend to belly laugh, which is that very sort of, you know, laughing so hard that it even hurts. They only tend to do that in response to slapstick. So the kind of thing we might see in a fail video or, you know, in the Three Stooges or something like that. That laughter, that laughing so hard that it even hurts, that's something that's completely unique to human beings. No other animal laughs in that way. And they found that that kind of laughter, in fact, raises people's sensitivity to pain. So people are less, you know, feel painful stimuli to be less painful when after they've laughed like that. And so, I mean, evolutionary psychologists can only hypothesize about the reasons for this, but the hypothesis was that this kind of laughter at this kind of entertainment is very, very, very old. And it's part of, it's played a really important part in, you know, bonding us together as a society, you know, keeping us in the groups that keep us safe, but also crucially allowing us to survive in very hostile environments by making us less sensitive to pain. I thought this was absolutely fascinating and perhaps goes some way to explaining our, you know, insatiable thirst, I think, for fail videos online.
How do you see the importance of empathy and that of Schadenfreude in today's culture being linked?
Well, I think this is a very interesting question. Actually, only a month or so ago, there was a paper published that made the claim, was reported as making the claim that Schadenfreude reveals like a moment of psychopathy in us all, and it claimed that Schadenfreude was the opposite of empathy, and you in fact get this quite a lot. So for about 100 years, really, there was no, in the 20th century, there was really no articles, scientific articles published with the word Schadenfreude in the title. But since about 2000, there have been hundreds. And there's a sudden boom of interest in this emotion. And you will often find psychologists defining Schadenfreude as anti-empathy or the opposite of empathy. And one reason for the interest in Schadenfreude is that it comes hot on the heel of, you know, a lot of interest in empathy over the last 20 odd years. But I think that this is a very simplistic way to understand the relationship between Schadenfreude and empathy. Of course, it might seem on the surface that that if you laugh at someone's misfortune, then that's the opposite of empathizing with it. But actually, when we are laughing at someone else's mishap, it requires all kinds of empathic processes to have taken place. You need to understand the kind of pain or discomfort that they might be feeling. Certainly, when it comes to embarrassment, we need to have a level of affective imagination going on so that we can put ourselves into their shoes and know what it is that they're feeling. Some people have talked about Schadenfreude actually as being even more of a sort of, less about the other person, but more of a sort of shudder or premonition of your own imminent disasters that you might experience. As I said before, you know, Schadenfreude reminds us it's not just us that fail, everyone does. But it also reminds us that when we see someone else fail, we also recognize our own potential failure and how sort of close to the wind we're sailing. So it almost has a sort of moment of vulnerability attached to it. I suppose what I'm trying to say is I think that relationship between Schadenfreude and empathy is far more complex and interesting than we're currently sort of framing it as. And I think it's something that we could look into more. And certainly in my book, that's one of the areas that I look into.
One of the ways you talk a little bit about in your book, by the way, my guest is Tiffany Watt-Smith, a historian of emotions. The name of her book is Schadenfreude, The Joy of Another's Misfortune. You write a little bit about some of the positive aspects of Schadenfreude and how Schadenfreude has been used in the tool to fight for large-scale causes like suffrage. How does suffragists use Schadenfreude to their advantage?
Well, you see this actually quite a lot in political movements, don't you? But suffragists used Schadenfreude because they used humor a lot. So they encouraged audiences to poke fun at or laugh at the kind of mishaps of other people. There was even this great story about suffragettes hiding. They were banned from taking part in public debates, but they snuck into a hall where an MP was speaking, and one of them hid in the organ, and they made spooky noises come out of the pipes while this MP was trying to give a very important speech. And so they kind of humiliated the MP, and the audience were laughing at the MP. And so they're kind of using the laughter as a way of kind of switching people's allegiances, getting them to pay attention, but also using that thing that we talked about earlier, you know, bringing people together. Laughter is one of the most cohesive emotions it's possible to have, and Schadenfreude is all about laughter. So if you can use if you can find a way to poke fun at the opposition, then you've got a chance of being able to kind of form people into a group behind you. And you see that whether you're looking at the suffragettes or you see it more recently. I still laugh when I see those responses to the binders full of women and adverts for binders on Amazon. Or over here we had Bic for Her, you know, the pens that were small and pink and were supposed to fit a lady's hand. And, you know, the internet piles on and everyone writes these sort of jokey reviews to highlight how ridiculous this is an idea. But it sort of just generates a lot of interest and fun, and that in turn generates a little bit of political momentum. They're small interventions, but they are important. George Orwell said that every joke is a tiny revolution.
I guess memes owe a lot to Schadenfreude, it sounds like.
I think a surprising amount, in fact.
At the very new book, I want to just quickly before we let you go, you have Schadenfreude, the Rules of Engagement. Number one, Schadenfreude works. Number two, Schadenfreude won't define you. Number three, Schadenfreude tells you things you don't want to know. Number four, own up to your Schadenfreude sometimes. And number five, Schadenfreude goes both ways. Why was it important to put these rules of engagement? And if there's one you'd like people to really remember, which one?
I think what I would be quite interested in is own up to your Schadenfreude somewhere. I thought the rules of engagement were important because, here's this emotion which is all around us and which we might feel more than we are usually comfortable admitting. And you might have got to the end of the book and think, oh, you know, what do I do now, you know, that I have this emotion that I'm not quite sure about. And I certainly had this response from some of my friends and early readers of the book. He said, you know, I felt kind of guilty and a little bit ashamed. And then I was really relieved to have a sort of like, you know, how to, what should I do with this feeling? So that was why these rules of engagement were particularly important. But the one that I wanted to highlight, which was own up to your Schadenfreude in brackets sometimes. Mm-hmm. Obviously most of us don't want to go around telling people when we are, you know, secretly gloating over some minor mishap of theirs. But sometimes you do feel Schadenfreude in a way that... Sorry, I'm sorry about that. I'm standing on the street after a mishap of my own on the way here.
Oh.
And a slightly crazed person just leapt into me. But anyway, so go on. Owning up to your Schadenfreude, I think, it can be important when you find yourself in having an uncomfortable moment of Schadenfreude. So, for example, you know, when you feel Schadenfreude towards someone you love, like one of your siblings, or even towards your partner or one of your close friends. And I think all of us from time to time have had this very unpleasant experience where you're genuinely commiserating about someone's bit of bad news, but you kind of notice that you also don't feel entirely terrible, but there's some sort of pleasure that you're having, and that's deeply, I find that very disconcerting when that has happened to me, and so I have learned actually to, however humiliating it is, to sort of try and find a way to say, you know, I felt this, you know, very inappropriate thing when we were talking the other day, and I just wanted to mention it. I think I probably was feeling envious about your new job or whatever it was.
Just own up to it.
You know, when I have,
you just have to own up to it.
And when I have said that to people, actually, they've been very understanding and usually laughed. And actually, usually it's made them feel slightly better because they've realized that I was, you know, I was feeling a bit envious of them. And everyone likes to have someone feel a little bit envious of them sometimes.
Tiffany, go get yourself someplace safe and off the streets. Tiffany Watt-Smith, the name of her book is Schadenfreude, The Joy of Another's Misfortune, is available now. Thanks so much for joining us. Coming up next, author Blythe Roberson gives us her thoughts on how to date men when you hate men. More after a quick break.
WNYC supporters include Salesforce Essentials, a CRM solution designed to help small businesses and startups pull data from email, calendars, and more to get a single 360 view of their businesses. More at salesforce.com/essentials. your part-time controller, helping nonprofit organizations with all of their accounting and financial reporting needs. Your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists. More at yourparttimecontroller.com.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We move now from Schadenfreude to another topic often fraught with difficult feelings, dating and relationships. According to my next guest, specifically dating men under a patriarchal system designed to oppress and manipulate women, and How to Date Men When You Hate Men, author Blythe Roberson ponders some of the big questions about the modern dating scene while offering a hilarious guide to navigating these treacherous waters. And Blythe joins me in studio. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So the title is a win. Blythe for the win. How did you get there?
I was actually shopping the book around under a much longer, much stupider title. And
what was it?
It was like... towards a unified theory of dating when all men hate me or something like that. It was just pseudo-philosophical. And my editor came up with it and said, if you sell it to anyone else, you can't have this, but here it is. Yeah.
What have been some of the responses to it?
There's a lot of people either immediately are like, this is my book, I need to read this book, or people really get their shackles up. Instagram banned, took down a photo my friend posted a couple times because they considered it hate speech. So that's kind of the two extremes.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
So now I Googled around and doing research on you, and you gave the speech to your class when you graduated from Harvard in 2013. And you said that the speech, quote, I found out I couldn't be a government concentrator because I wanted to write, quote, think pieces about Twilight novels.
Yeah.
So how do you tackle subjects which might seem sort of frothy on the surface, but really you want to go at it in a meaningful way?
Yeah, well, that's so funny. I literally watched Twilight last night while writing a think piece about Harry Styles. But yeah, I think there's a lot of things that are marketed towards women are considered frothy or frivolous, I think because society tells us that women are frothy and frivolous and less than. But these things, you know, give me a lot of enjoyment, give me a lot of pleasure. I really like One Direction. I like Twilight. And I think they're worth thinking about because women are taught to spend so much time thinking about them. So if we're going to have marketing tell us that we should read and watch Twilight, it's worth thinking, what are the sexual dynamics of this story? What are the undertones that are maybe really unhealthy to take away from that? And what are the good things about it? Why do we like it so much? So I think anything that you enjoy warrants just really sitting down and thinking about it. So why not Twilight?
So with that in mind, the way you described approaching that, you described this as a comedy philosophy book. So what does that mean? And who do you really think is your reader?
Yeah, so this is based on a book of philosophy by Roland Barthes, A Lover's Discourse, where he takes words and phrases associated with love and romance, like engulfment and waiting, and just writes his own thoughts about it. And I was like, I could do that same thing. Like, that's so easy just to pick, like, being chill and just writing my own thoughts about it. Why is that any less philosophy than if a man wrote it, you know? Some French dude in the 70s. So that's kind of where the philosophy comes in. It is kind of like a micro essay collection, but it's also just like my big thoughts about it. It's not reported. But when I read A Lover's Discourse, I really loved it. I thought it was so spot on in a lot of ways, but I also was like, this could have jokes in it and be just as good. So that's where the comedy comes in.
At what point did you realize that dating and having relationships with men had a political element for you?
It almost happened during the writing of the book. It was kind of a discovery process how many of the things I had been thinking about as like personal failures had political elements to it. And I mean, everyone's heard the phrase, the personal is the political. But it really took me sitting down in my room alone, having to focus on men who told me they couldn't date anyone who was more successful than they are, to really think that's kind of actually messed up of them. It's not just because they met me, a person who's really career focused, and thought that I was a goblin. It, you know, has larger implications that
not
why are
goblin.
Men. That's how I self-identify.
Oh,
yeah. So it was like, oh, wow, there are so many elements of this that do relate to patriarchy. And it makes sense because it's like one of the most intimate relationships, but it's also one of the most widespread ways that people are oppressed in society. So
It was interesting when I was reading it. You brought up Naomi Wolf's The Beauty Myth.
Yeah.
And the similarity of the amount of time women are supposed to spend thinking about finding a relationship, healing a relationship, keeping a relationship.
Yeah.
Just is a time suck from everything else.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that realization came when a guy was giving me the wildest flirting signals of all time, just doing things that made no sense but were criminally flirty. And I was like, why is he not asking me out? And then I was like, I could be thinking about political organizing right now, and the fact that I'm not is political.
My guess is Blythe Roberson, the name of her book is How to Date Men When You Hate Men. You don't hate men.
Yeah, I don't hate men, although I've started saying I should just tell people I hate men because the men are reacting so poorly to it.
But oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, where it's just like, oh, well, oh, you don't really hate men. And it's like, well, I don't, but now I hate you for like being so rude to me about it. It's really more, I quote Mary Poppins, the suffragette song where the mom sings, we adore men individually, but we agree as a group they're rather stupid. So it's kind of like, I don't hate individual men, but I hate a patriarchal society that gives them all this power and teaches them that they en masse can treat women a certain way. That's really degrading.
As you're going through your own thoughts and writing all this down, what are some things that women can, things that we have control over in these situations that we can do so that it's not a situation that makes you feel less than, makes you feel like you're waiting by the phone, makes you feel ghosted, dusted, whatever?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it's tough because there's, I don't want to be like a Sheryl Sandberg lean-in feminist who says, like, you through individual will can right all of society's wrongs. But I think for me, the biggest thing has been trying to strive for communication in relationships, because if you're meeting a guy and you like him enough to want to go out with him, chances are he's trying, like, he's a sweet guy, he's trying to be a good person. So really all you can do is, when things come up, say, this makes me feel uncomfortable, I feel like this is weighted in XYZ way, here's a layer to this that you might not have ever been conditioned to consider, but this is why it makes me feel weird, and deal with it in the moment as much as you can.
It's interesting. As I was reading your book, I thought this is like just a great book to give a friend after a breakup.
Yeah.
When she's feeling vulnerable, or even he. I mean, it could, you know, it can go both ways. Just feeling really raw and sort of alone. I just want to say that.
Thank you so much. There's no question there.
My next question was, though, you're really anti-dating app, which is what kids your age do to meet each other.
Yeah.
Why are you so anti-dating app?
So I always felt uncomfortable with them, and I never really sat
down. I'm teasing you about being.
It's like, it's so true though. Like, so many of my friends are like, oh, I just met this guy on like Bumble or Hinge. And I'm like, well, all I can do is like see a hot person in real life and follow up about it. But they always made me uncomfortable. And I realized while writing this book that like they are, in my opinion, like dating as capitalism in a way, where like you're making yourself a product and you're like, what is my brand? What is my like catchphrase? And like, I have to beat out all these other people who are like trying to get the same consumers basically. And I was just like, oh God, I like am a communist and I don't want to be a like dating capitalist, if that makes sense.
You write, quote, commodify yourself in a way that makes you metaphorically nauseous and also kind of physically nauseous.
Yeah. Yeah. It really does stress me out in such a way that, like, I feel like my hands are on fire, you know?
And you also take aim at some of the popular culture. You know, the idea of that rom-coms, and I do kind of agree with it, that rom-coms can ruin people.
Yeah. It's even the ones that I really love. Like, I grew up watching a lot of When Harry Met Sally and You've Got Mail, which I still think are some of the greatest movies ever made. But there are just so many ways in which the narratives are so just unhealthy or like do not hold up to any kind of scrutiny. Like in You've Got Mail, Tom Hanks is just rude to her the whole time. So
yes.
I grew up being like, oh, being mean is flirting. And then the whole third act of the movie, he knows that Meg Ryan's in love with him and she doesn't know that he's her internet crush, and he just like gaslights her the whole time and makes her think that she's totally crazy. And it's like, why would did I ever think that was romantic?
Have your views about dating changed since you've written the book? Written it, read it, going out talking about it?
Yeah, it's definitely made me just a lot more cognizant of ways in which things are bigger than me, in ways that it's not like I'm failing personally, but ways that society has kind of messed up the way that men and women relate to one another. But it's also just made me like feel less stupid for thinking about it so much. Like, I wrote this book and I was like, I don't really want to write a book about dating. All women only write about dating and like their anxiety disorders. But after thinking about it so long, I'm like, no, this is actually a really important thing to think about.
The name of the book is How to Date Men When You Hate Men, perhaps with one of the best blurbs ever. Quote, How to Date Men When You Hate Men is an incredibly funny read that was surely not written when Blythe was supposed to be working for me, Stephen Colbert. Blythe, thanks so much for coming in the studio. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll be back after the break. This wraps up our Feeling All the Feelings and Hour of Attitude. We'll see you on the other side of the news.